Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Many of us know what it feels like to fall in love. The attraction, the chemistry, the excitement. But what's it like to fall in love with an ashtray?
I like that it's smelly, very dirty. I like touch, hug with ashtray.
And what's it like to wholeheartedly love a chandelier?
I mean, she looks amazing, you know, all her little curls and her swells and the angles. And I've never seen another chandelier that looks like her.
Hear what love is like for people who identify as objectum sexual, plus a sexologist on what the rest of us get wrong about them.
These are people who have legitimate relationships and should be respected as any sexual or gender minority should be respected.
I'm Kyone Wolf. That's coming up next on Audacious, right after the news. From Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, I'm Kyone Wolf, and on Audacious, we love talking about love. There was that one episode full of advice from people who've been married for over 50 years. There was another episode about people who find real love and fulfillment with, well, calling them sex dolls is a bit limiting, with realistic-looking, life-sized, human-resembling synthetic companions. And today we're going to talk about and with people who are objectum sexuals. Here's my first guest defining it for you.
I basically define it in the same way that objectum sexuals do, and that is as a sexual orientation. It's not a fetish. I mean, there are people who fetishize objects, but it's not a fetish because these are full-blown, complex, multi-emotional relationships that run the gamut, you know, between same sex or different sex preferences, if they detect gender in an object. Some people are polyamorous and have a number of objects. Some people are monogamous with their objects. It can be very romantic. It can be affectionate. It can be definitely erotic. It's a full spectrum.
That's Amy Marsh. Amy is a sexologist with a private practice as a sexuality counselor. And Amy identifies as a non-binary femme and goes by the pronouns Z and Zir. Now, before we get going, a few things to keep in mind. The stuff we're going to talk about isn't explicitly sexual, but, you know, this one's maybe not for every age group. And in this first segment, you're going to hear Amy mention the OS group, which is the Objectum Sexuality International Group, a support network for objectum sexuals that also provides education and insights to the wider world. And you'll hear the word animist, which is defined as the belief that objects, places, and creatures all possess a distinct spiritual essence. Later in the show, you'll hear from people who are in relationships with an ashtray and a chandelier. But first, I wanted Amy to help us understand more about objectum sexuality, and specifically a survey that Z shared with the OS International Group to get a broader understanding of how they see themselves. I asked Amy what Z learned from Z's survey.
I think the big thing that struck me immediately was how natural these relationships are for the people who are engaged in them. And I was originally drawn to it because I had been exploring sexual relationships for people on the autism spectrum. And I had noticed in the OS website that some of the people had been diagnosed or some people felt that they had significant traits of autism. So that initially drew me into it. And then just seeing, I would say it was not a very scientific survey. It was originally designed for the membership of OS International and the English-speaking people who could respond to it. So it was quick, it was well thought out, but it was not something that I could publish other than as a general article, you know, in a journal. But the qualitative responses where people are actually talking about their experiences and how they relate to their objects. This was stunning because, again, it ran the gamut.
You said you were drawn in because of this, the people saying that they were on the autism spectrum. Did you discover any more about that as you heard these stories?
Yeah, some people, there became a little further down the line, some people saying, yeah, you know, I really identify as being autistic, and other people saying, I don't believe that autism is part of my picture, and I identify more as an animist. And I think it's really important to keep those two different things in mind when we talk about objectum sexuality. But the interesting thing is in 2019, I believe it's Judith Simner and a couple of other people, researchers out of England, did a study wondering if objectum sexuality was linked to autism and also to something which I'd proposed, which was object personification synesthesia. And yay, they found links. So that was cool.
Whoa. There's a lot in there.
There is, yeah.
And it's, I imagine it's something that, I guess, like, any human behavior, especially when you tie in sexuality and romance and desires and the way our brains work, like you'll never really be done figuring it out, what it means, how it happens.
That's a fun part of this field, definitely. Just yesterday, though, I found a model of sexual orientation that dates from the 90s, but it was just published in a book by William R. Staton, Sinless Sex, A Challenge to Religions. And this is such a beautiful model of sexual orientations because he adds objects, he adds deities, and his contention is the same as mine, is basically human beings can eroticize pretty much anything, and they do. It was a brilliant model, and I just love it. And dating from the 90s, how perfect, but I hadn't heard of it before.
Yeah, I mean, you make me think about how quickly it seems like we're evolving, at least in the bubble, you know, that is where I am in the United States in this era we're in. But as a 41-year-old on the LGBTQIA plus spectrum, I've seen a lot of growth in my community when it comes to acceptance of folks who are into different things. But at the same time, someone might be driving to work and hear the promo for this episode and go, what? So that being said, what are the ways that people misunderstand objectum sexuals? And what do you wish they would know? What should people take away from this episode?
The misconceptions are that the people are crazy, that they have some kind of mental illness that makes them delusional, that they can't get a human date, that they've been traumatized. And that's not the case, really. I mean, yeah, there are some people who are dealing with depression or PTSD or something else, but at least in the small sample that were in the survey and then people I've talked to since, they're not reporting those kinds of diagnoses. And not everybody has been traumatized. This is just simply a wiring, really, more than anything else. And so the sensational aspect of it lends to a lot of troll behavior. And I think that's unfortunate. So remembering that these are people who have legitimate relationships and should be respected as any sexual or gender minority should be respected. These are folks who are going to experience a number of things in their relationships. Sometimes they may need support from counselors or therapists. Sometimes that will be related to their relationship and sometimes not. But the last thing you want is to have to educate your therapist or your counselor in order to get them to even see that you're there to talk about your dentistry or something else, and not always hyper-focus on, oh my God, this person's in a relationship that's so weird to me and I don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I think about the evolution of therapy with people on the LGBTQIA plus spectrum. When I remember when I was young, I saw a therapist, and my first meeting with her and last was, she said, okay, so you're a lesbian. And I said, yeah. And she said, so how long have you wanted to be a boy?
Oh.
And that was it for never. These are two different, this is not, and I was a teenager, so I couldn't necessarily be as confident in my informing as I would as an adult. But when you think about how fast things are evolving in terms of people being like, hey, you do you, you know, I can Google it and learn more about it so you don't have to do that heavy lifting. When you look at the future of understanding objectum sexuals, what do you think would be different then in a better world for them than there is now?
I'd say most of the trauma that objectum sexuals experience are from people treating them poorly because of their relationship or treating the objects poorly. I mean, I know of a couple instances where people have been threatened and controlled by harm being done to or threatened to be done to the beloved object. I mean, you can imagine how terrifying that is. So if I imagine a better world, it's exactly what you said a little while ago. It's like, you do you, I'll learn about it. It's like, your object beloved is not my deity god spouse, but your objectum sexual lover is okay. I just want to see more acceptance.
Speaking of deities, your most recent focus is on spiritual.
I'm using two terms, spiritu intimacy and spectrosexuality. Now, there's a category in the sexological literature of spectrophilia, which is, you know, a fetishized longing for sex with a ghost, basically, is that definition. But there are a number of people who have experienced deeply erotic encounters with non-corporeal beings, and some remain in long-term relationships with one or more non-corporeal being. It's throughout history, culture, religious and spiritual traditions, you name it. It's like the big thing we're not talking about yet, but it's utterly fascinating. And it brings me to objectum sexuality, because if you look at the objects that people are engaged with, are they actually tapping into an inherent spirit of the chair or the ashtray or the glass or whatever it is they're relating to? Or have they done a kind of theurgistic process of imbuing or inviting a spirit in to that object without knowing it? It's like the Velveteen Rabbit story that they have for kids. When you get loved, you become real. Is that what's happening? We don't know. But there is definitely a sense of two-way communication for most of the people that I've talked with, not entirely. And sometimes the communication is not verbal. It's maybe sensing heat or some other sort of synesthesia process going on in the communication.
That is so freaking fascinating.
It is super fascinating.
When someone feels drawn to objects, and, you know, they can Google for themselves, and, you know, we're in this era where they can look for help. But if somebody is listening to this and they think, this is me, oh my God, I thought I was the only one, or this is me and I know I'm not the only one, but I don't like it. I wish I wasn't like this because it's hard. What can they do?
So that initial feeling of, I wish I wasn't like that, this is hard. That's a difficult place to be in. But we know that trying to change your orientation or orientations doesn't really work. And I think the best support and antidote to that is to find others like you and to be in community and talk and find that it is normalized among a group of people. So then you begin to understand that it's not just you, and maybe some of that loneliness will go away. But it may not make your life any easier because you're still having to deal with other people's prejudices.
Yeah, it's funny. As you're talking, I'm reflecting on the fact that I was like, God, that's fascinating. And it is. And there's so many doors to kind of walk through. And at the same time, like, I want to be fascinating for all of me, not one part of me. And so I wonder if you have an attraction to objects, if it's like, I'm more than this too, right?
Right. Yeah. Why should they always be seen as that one aspect of themselves that, yes, getting you on radio and television and podcasts and stuff, but you're into other stuff, you know, you have a fuller life. A lot of people are engaged in other kinds of relationships with human beings and not just people in their, well, I should say with human beings outside the OS community, and they're doing stuff. They're living life just as anybody else is. But that hyper-focus, it's necessary to kind of get the word out and let people know. And on the other hand, it can be a little detrimental or intrusive, I think, for some people.
Yeah, limiting.
Yeah.
What does this work do for you? I mean, this is work. I imagine that, you know, like we talked about, you're never going to understand all of this, and it is a very fertile soil that you are digging in. What does this work do for you personally?
I would say I have an intellectual as well as an emotional attachment to doing this work. And I like to help people, obviously like to be useful in that way. We don't get much encouragement in this culture to explore our own inner erotic landscape. And the people who do get to do that, or who have decided to embark on that, they go to some pretty interesting places, and they learn about themselves deeply, and they learn about other lovers, whether corporeal, object, or human. They'll also learn.
Well, did I miss anything in this grand landscape of questioning? But for this particular show, did I miss anything?
I don't think so, except I guess I'd like to just leave it with the idea that clinicians of all kinds need to educate themselves, not just about objective sexuality, but other forms of human sexual behavior that seems unusual to them. The biggest mistake you can do is try to function from what you think you yourself is, quote unquote, normal or average. And you just cannot do that. So get educated and do not shame anybody who comes into your office and tells you that, you know, their significant other is a crossbow or a lantern or whatever.
Amy Marsh, thank you for talking with me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You can find links to Amy's website and Objectum Sexuality International at our website, ctpublic.org/audacious. When we get back, what's it like to fall in love with the Statue of Liberty?
When I did and got on the boat and went over, oh, that was such a special moment.
And what's the appeal of an ashtray?
It's kinky for other people, but I love it. And it's my personal life.
I'm Kion Wolf. This is Audacious. Stay with me. Love is an ashtray that spills in your lap. This is Audacious. I'm Kion Wolf. Today we're getting a better understanding of what it's like to fall in love and or lust with objects. In a little bit, you'll meet a woman who changed her last name to Liberty when she fell in love with the Statue of Liberty, and who is now smitten with a very seductive chandelier. But right now, you get to meet Yuri Torochko. He's an LGBTQIA+ activist, bodybuilder, and artist living in Nur-Sultan, Kazakhstan. He's also an objectum sexual, whose latest love is an ashtray. But the ashtray wasn't the first object to catch his eye. You'll hear more about the other objects of his affection, and you should know that this interview does get slightly not safe for work or kids, but the thing about him that made headlines in the last couple of years was his marriage to his sex dolls. They're realistic-looking, life-sized, human-resembling synthetic companions, Luna and Lola. I asked him to tell me about them.
They are really different, and it's why I love them. Lola is absolutely my fantasy. I love that she has a head of woman and body of chicken. It's unusual, it's surrealistic, but I like surrealistic things with my childhood. It's my nature. But Luna is very tender, very delicate, and very sexy for me. Luna is more sexy for me, but Lola is more for soul comfort for me. And also, I love that Lola is very soft, and sometimes I love to lay my head on her stomach like a pillow.
What's the difference to you between a relationship with an object and a relationship with a human?
It's really not the same. And when I say that I love my Lola, Lunas, or another object, it's not the same when I love the human, the person. What? It's really different. But you can feel, love her car, violent musical instrument, and it's similar. It's similar feeling, but I love the story with these objects and dolls, not only sexual experience. And sex is different too, because some people ask me, what's the best, sex with a real woman or guy or with doll? It's different. It's different.
And it's different between human beings anyway, right? You know, like no two people are alike. So why wouldn't people be different than objects?
Yes, yes.
I'd love to hear about the ashtray. That was the first thing that brought us to you, was your experience with this ashtray. Tell me the story. The first time you laid eyes on this ashtray, what happened?
I perform at the gay club weekend. And the ashtray is in the smoking room there. And I, about two or three times a week, I see it. And I like that it's very smelly, very dirty. I like touch, hug with ashtray. And I like that it's not new. I like that it's old, has a story, and and using for people, what it's benefit for people. Of course, when I have a break and I don't see it a week or two, a couple of weeks, and of course I miss, because I have need to feel like a dirty animal.
I was going to ask you if you miss it when it's gone. Like, you long for it. You miss it. You want to be back with it.
Yes.
What is it about that ashtray that's different, that gets your heart racing, than other ashtrays?
I like another ashtrays too. I like another ashtrays, but I don't like totally new ashtray. I like things with story, with feedback, or background, with background. What it's important for me. It excites me.
Is it also exciting to see people using the ashtray for their cigarettes or cigars?
Yes, 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 yes. I like, and I like be dirty and smelly and like an animal. It's true. Maybe it's kinky for other people, but I love it.
The heart wants what the heart wants, Yuri.
Yes, yes. And it's my personal life.
Yep, it sure is. What kind of response do you get to your attraction to this ashtray from, like, you know, your friends and people who know about it?
I think it's strange for many people, my feeling and my fetishes. They often tell me that I'm crazy, I'm wild, I'm savage, but they still love me. Really often they say, I'm wild, but I'm funny. What? No, it's my nature.
And you deserve to be happy.
Yes, yes, it's important to be happy.
Well, you can. You've mentioned your childhood a few times. So this attraction to objects and their stories goes back to then?
Objects was really fantastic and mystical for me with my childhood. I loved fantasy stories in my childhood. And when I was 5 years old, I started to write such stories. I wrote 4 books of poems in Russia, and I was starting with my childhood, and it was fantasy stories.
I have to think that you are misunderstood in a lot of ways. In what ways do people not understand your love and your affection and your attraction?
Maybe, but many people of love that I show my sexuality, because many people have need with it.
You are a very outspoken activist for the LGBTQIA plus community in Kazakhstan. And at a rally, you were beaten up pretty badly. Why is it important to you to stand up for sexual minorities?
I live in the really homophobic, transphobic, biphobic country. And it's really dangerous to be gay, lesbian, pansexual, bisexual here. But for me, the greatest value is human life. And I believe that we should protect LGBT rights, people rights. I supported transgender people on the rally. I supported also Victoria Berhajaeva. She is a transgender woman. She is in a prison and she was raped several times there.
And you'd go to these rallies and you're a very large man with a lot of muscle and you would wear a dress to these rallies, yeah?
It was a democratic rally. It was democratic people, but when I was at female look it, their behavior was not democratic.
Yeah, you dress like a woman and things changed for you.
Yes, yes. It was a challenge for them and for us, for people in this country.
What were your injuries?
I had concussions, broken nose, broken two teeth.
Your eye was swollen shut too.
Yes, yes. But I'm good now and I'm proud what I did because I could take attention to this problem. Because a lot of journalists, a lot of people in Kazakhstan discuss it.
I am on the LGBTQ plus spectrum as well. And I think, you know, it's been a long time that people in our community have been fighting for recognition, for equality. But then there are people who don't have a letter yet, you know, who aren't LGBTQ. They are somewhere in between and changing and growing and discovering new things they love. And when I think about you showing up for those rallies and I think about you being outspoken about what you love, it makes me think there's so much more to us than just those letters. And so fighting for your equality is fighting for everybody's.
I believe that we should protect and support all human rights and not only human, nature, ecology too, because it's connect for our life. I protect not only LGBT, I protect also ecology, woman rights, not only LGBT. But LGBT in our country is really not security. And you should be really brave to tell about it and more brave to go to the square where there are really a lot of people, homophobic people, так далее.
Well, Yuri Torochko, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, too.
After the break.
You don't have to have organs to have feelings.
I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Be right back.
Now there's three cigarettes in the ashtray.
This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf. Today, life as an objectum sexual, a person who's attracted to objects. Amanda Liberty of Leeds, England, is no stranger to love. Her first love was with a drum set in her childhood, but I asked her to back me up and talk about what she remembers about her earliest memories of perceiving and developing a relationship with things.
It's difficult, really, because it sort of grew from my interest, as most children have, in teddy bears or whatever. Most people are animist when they are small. And animist means to be feeling energies from objects, you know, to feel that they have a life, to feel like they have a personality within them. Kind of, it just kind of grew from that. Whereas I think most people lose that aspect as they grow up, you know, they sort of realize, no, it's not real, so to speak. But for me, it was always real. I don't know how other people feel because I'm not them. But it kind of just developed from that childhood instinct into love for objects, you know, like I always loved them anyway. So it just sort of developed into having relationships with them when I got older.
Well, I'd like to ask about your first love. It was a drum set. You were 14 years old. Now, I'm a drummer. My drum set is in the basement and it brings me such joy. Cute. I definitely can understand the attraction to a degree. Can you describe what that connection was like to this drum set? Will you talk about, is it a physical attraction? Is it an emotional connection? What's there?
Both, you know, a physical and an emotional attraction. Definitely emotional. It was just extreme happiness, you know, just to be there with my drum kit, you know, and I'd play there and feel like that the drums were extensions of me, you know, like my drumsticks were part of me as well. And then the drum kit as well was part of me as well. And I could take out all my frustrations on my drum kit, which
me
I'm sure everyone
too.
Can.
Me
I'm sure
too.
Everyone can.
The crash cymbal, the ride, and the hi-hat are my particular favorites. So just smash.
Yeah. It was always the kick drum for me.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But so here's the thing. Like, I think, oh, I am with you. Not 100% on this, but there's a deeper feeling that you felt for this drum kit. That how would you articulate it was different than the way I feel about my drum kit?
Well, I suppose because of the animism, you know, feeling energy from it, feeling that my drum kit had a personality, that my drum kit was my friend, you know, to begin with. I think that's what it was, you know, to start with. My drum kit was my friend, and then I just ended up falling in love, and it felt completely natural to me. So I suppose me falling in love with my drum kit is what's different to what you are.
Your last name is Liberty. So I got to ask about the Statue of Liberty. You are one of the biggest collectors in the UK, if not in the world, of replica statues of Liberty. You have over 200 in your home. Will you bring me back to the first time that you saw the Statue of Liberty with your eyeballs and you said, oh my God.
Yeah, that was exactly what it was. I mean, I fell in love with her over the internet. You know, it was like pictures and images and through some of my collection that I'd amassed before I went to New York. I think we'd been together for about a year and a half before I went to New York. And then when I did and got on the boat and went over, oh, that was such a special moment. I think a lot of people can relate to that, though. I mean, for me, I just felt a really personal connection. Like, I was seeing my daughter for the first time in person, and she was standing right there in front of me across the water, but I was amazed. Just my jaw went to the floor.
Will you talk about what you feel back from the Statue of Liberty, or what you felt back? Because I can feel your emotion towards her. That's palpable. But obviously, as somebody who doesn't pick up on what you pick up on, how do you interpret energy from her?
I just feel it. You know, it's just something I feel. I feel her emotions. I feel that, even though, you know, obviously she doesn't have a brain. I've been inside her crown, so I know that she doesn't have a brain. You know, I've been inside her head.
You got inside her head, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not like that. It's not physically like that. You don't have to have organs to have feelings, in my view. You know, to me, you know, I mean, if you look at the materials that the Statue of Liberty is made of, you've got copper, you've got iron, you've got stainless steel, and the pedestal is granite. So you've got all of these things that come from the earth, you know, and a lot of people can relate to the earth and plants and life form and crystals and things like that, which I'll get into later with the chandeliers. It's like all that stuff comes out from the earth, and that is what animism is. So suppose she's an extension of that, and plus what she means as well. I mean, to me, the Statue of Liberty means freedom. She means justice. She means responsibility as well, you know. But I feel she feels that I am special. I mean, I still have that with her now, you know. I still do love her. I've never fallen out of love with her, and I look forward to the next time I can go, you know, obviously.
Let's talk about Lumiere, who, of course, is named after the chandelier in Beauty and the Beast, and with whom you are in a relationship with right now. Will you tell me about how you met and how that relationship blossomed?
Absolutely. I mean, she was named actually by somebody else. She was named by a friend of mine. Lumiere, she told me, means light in French, so that's an easy one. I again met her on the internet. You know, there's a theme here, the internet.
Yeah, you and the rest of the world, but yeah.
Yeah. So I got her from Germany. She was actually in Germany on eBay, and I thought, oh, I'm not going to be able to get her, you know, posting her and the amount of money that she was up for on eBay. I thought, no, it's not going to be happening. You know, I'm not going to be getting her. And I waited a couple of weeks. I ended up emailing the guy who is German, but he spoke good English. And I managed to get a settlement to get her. You know, I agreed. You know, he reduced his price for me a little bit. And we packed her up in a box and shipped her over, so you can say that she's my mail order bride.
Now, wait a minute. What of all the chandeliers in the world, what was it about Lumiere that made you think, oh my gosh, that she's for me?
Well, of course, on the internet, it was more of a physical attraction than anything else. Just the way that she looks. I mean, she looks amazing, you know, all her little curls and her swells and the angles and just everything about her. She's a perfect form to me. It's like I've never seen another chandelier that looks like her, and being absolutely interested in chandeliers, I mean, I've restored over 150 chandeliers, and I've been all over the world basically seeing different chandeliers here, there and everywhere. I've never seen another one that matches her. I'd love to know if anybody out there has one that is just like my Lumiere. I'd just love to know if she's got a twin somewhere out there, because, you know, I've never seen one. I think I've seen a pair that were by the same maker. I mean, I don't know who made her, and she can't tell me that information. They don't have that kind of communication with me. The communication is more just, you know, feeling how they are feeling and what they are thinking and things like that. You know, it's not, they can't tell me about the history or where she was before she came to that shop in Germany, you know, the past 100 years of her life. I have no idea where she was, what she was doing or anything.
Do you speak to her? Do you have conversations with her either out loud or, I mean, for lack of a better term, telepathically? Like, how do you communicate?
I sometimes speak to her in person, but it's never like a conversation. I'll just say, hi, Lumiere, or I love you, you're beautiful, and things like that. That's what I say in person. But when I think of but more of an emotionally side of it, you know, I kind of just feel our energies. You know, it's not a communication through verbal communication. It's just through feeling, basically. But that's enough for me. I mean, a lot of people will turn around and say, well, you know, that's not really much, you know, she's not there to give you a hug and things like that, like humans are. But for me, it doesn't matter. To me, it doesn't matter at all. You know, I look past all of that. I think that's what it is. I look past it all. I don't put walls around myself. You know, I don't deny things that other people might do. I think that's probably why that it works for me, because I don't deny things.
We were talking earlier about how, you know, Lumiere can't necessarily like hug you back, and we are not going to talk about any sort of sex stuff, but I am curious to know, like, when you touch, what does it feel like to touch her?
For me, I feel energy through the touch, you know. I feel like, again, she's an extension to me. I feel like my energy, my warmth of my hand flows into her cold metal, and then her metal warms up because she's been next to my arm, and there is a transference of physical energy, but it's also emotional. You know, it just feels really good to touch her. You know, I just feel a spark. You know, I feel like electricity goes up my arm, but not as in zapping, you know.
Oh, that's she's, not off the table.
She's well wired, you know. That no, more of an emotional, spiritual connection between ourselves.
Earlier you were talking about crystals, and I thought that was a really cool point, because I mean, there are plenty of people who feel energy from crystals. You know, they put them in the windowsill on a full moon to recharge them. And while these folks, you know, they probably may at times feel misunderstood, but you know, they aren't the topic of radio shows like mine, right? So I'd like to hear what you think about how many people connect with crystals and how they and those feelings compare to the relationship that you have with Lumiere.
Well, a lot of people feel energies from crystals. You know, I mean, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago, a chandelier dealer down in London. I was having a conversation with them, and he was giving me loads of rock crystals and things to hold. And I was holding them, and I feel great energy from this. And he was saying, I always do, that's why I opened this place, and that's why I do this job, because of how I feel about the crystals. You know, it started from that. You know, they come from the earth. You know, if you talk about rock crystal or rock crystal, quartz crystal, it comes straight from the earth. You know, literally dig it out and then shape it to be whatever, like a chandelier crystal or whatever. And you know, the energies that come from that is just really special. You can feel it. You can feel it going up your arms and things. And that's how I feel with the Lumiere as well, you know, with her metal, you know, that again comes from the earth. Yeah, so it just all goes back to and ties to. It's a way of trying to find ways to relate to the rest of the world who doesn't feel exactly like I do with objects, but trying to find a way for them to relate in some way, at least, where they can feel energy from objects, and crystal is a good one to start with.
And then there is, of course, the bonus of Lumiere that she's never gonna cheat on you. You know, she's never gonna lie. You're never gonna get hurt or betrayed by this love.
Some people will think, oh, it's easy to be in love with an object. You don't have all the arguments. You don't have the fights. You don't have to worry about them getting hurt particularly. You don't have to worry about them leaving you. You don't have to worry about this. You don't have to worry about that. It's like, it's just easy, you know, always going to be there, no problem. But it's actually harder to be in love with objects, I think, because then other people don't really understand, you know. It's a battle to get other people just to open their minds a little bit and just accept it. You know, I'm not asking for everyone to understand 100%. You know, I am aware it's difficult for people, you know, and I understand that and accept that. You know, that because it's not a life you need, it's difficult to understand how it works for somebody else. But I'd say this about myself and about anybody else who is different. Again, you know, unless you've been in those situations, unless you know how it feels, then how can you just stand there and say that's wrong, or you judge it? You know, it's like, I don't get it. I don't get the closed-mindedness of some people. And I think, that's the hardest part of being in love with an object, because you get, you know, you have to explain yourself a million times over just to get a little bit of love and acceptance and respect from people. I think that's what I want above all else, is just acceptance and respect as well. You know, like, everyone deserves respect. You know, and if you see me and Luria together, you'll see I'm happy. You know, you might not see her happiness, but she is happy. But you see mine, and it's like, just be happy for me.
Makes me wonder, what would the world look like? How would you move throughout this world differently if people got it? If it wasn't something you really had to explain and to get on public radio shows and talk about, how would your life be different? What would it look like?
Oh, no, there's a question I've never been asked before. Yes, she's cheering. Well, I guess it'd be a lot easier, because then I wouldn't have to explain myself. I'd just be able to go out there and say, you know, I'm in love with Lumia. You know, she's my chandelier at home. Here's a picture of them. Then other people will go, oh, wow, you know, that's wonderful. I'm so happy for you. You know, have you been together long? Yeah, you know, have you been together long, and how did you meet, and things like that? You know, it'd be just things like that.
The questions everybody else gets.
Exactly. You know, because we still have all of that.
Would you take her out to dinner?
Well, it's difficult because, you know, she is, you know, there is limits, unfortunately. You know, some chandeliers are okay. I mean, she's quite heavy, you know, don't want to damage her all the time.
But, not quite portable.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't want to damage her. I mean, I don't move her from the spot where she hangs. She hangs in my living room in the corner. You know, that's where she hangs, and she doesn't move from there. You know, I go over to her if I want to see her, you know. Or I look at her like I'm doing now, and I'm like, ooh, she's amazing.
Oh, I see.
You know, I look at her, and I'm like, ooh, she's amazing. You know, she's gorgeous, Shindy. So, yeah, I think that's what I'd really like. I'd really like to be able to live in a world like that, where you can just, you know, some people can just be happy for me. Well, happy for us, happy for our relationship, you know, happy for us as a person and as a chandelier, you know.
Would you say that being an objectum sexual is, to you, a sexual orientation? You know, it's not something you chose, it's not something you can or want to change, it's got its own culture. Would you say that is the case for you, that you see it as a sexual orientation?
Absolutely, 100%. I do believe that I fit on the LGBTQIA+OS. So, you know, there's a million of those now. And I'll be honest, I don't know what every single one means. I need to research that a bit more. But I accept everybody. But I believe that is where I fit on the scale of things. It is a sexual orientation, like heterosexual, homosexual, objection sexual. You know, it's just, it doesn't mean necessarily that you are being sexual.
Just like asexual.
Exactly. Right. It means that is where you are attracted.
And then hopefully it'll be someday as boring as everybody else.
Hopefully it'll just be accepted like everyone else. Yeah. That's what I would like, ideally, in this world, just to have what other people have in terms of their love and their life being accepted by everyone else. You know, I find a lot of people do accept me the way I am, though. Yeah, you know, I suppose because I am willing to speak out about it. You know, I'm not quiet.
Well, Amanda Liberty, I am truly happy for you, and she's beautiful, and you look beautiful together. So thank you. And thank you for talking with me.
You're completely welcome. You know, if we don't do this, then we're not going to be able to help people to be open-minded.
Audacious is produced by me, Jessica Severin DeMartinez, and Katie Talarski at Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. Subscribe to Audacious and you'll always get to hear the show a day early. Plus, you can listen back to the shows I mentioned earlier, like the one about what it's like to use a therapy baby to cope with depression and anxiety, and how dating a synthetic person can be an act of self-love. You can hear them all at ctpublic.org/audacious or wherever you get your podcasts. Send me your reactions and show ideas on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Kyone Wolf. And my email is cwolf@ctpublic.org. Thanks for listening.